It's Wrestling Observer Radio with Garrett and Dave, and today we have a special guest, Tim Marchman, features editor at Vice News, who has been reporting on the Vince McMahon situation since the Janelle Grant lawsuit became public. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, guys.
Why don't you kick it off, Dave?
Okay. Well, I mean, Tim, you know, I mean, you've done a really good job as, you know, reporting on some of the stuff. And it's, to me, the really biggest wrestling news story that there is. I mean, it's the lawsuit itself was horrific. And then, you know, you brought up, you've written about some of the Ashley Massaro stuff from years ago. And I mean, I think that, you know, when it came out first, years ago, you know, and WWE defended it. And I mean, the two things that really have stuck out for me in this kind of latest incarnation of the story with stuff that you've written and other people is that, number one, the story that the WWE told me and other reporters at the time, you know, that there was, you know, they didn't know that there was no meeting, then all that stuff is clearly been disproven. Considering, you know, what Dr. Ferdinand Rios said, what John Laurinaitis said, or his lawyer said, and things like that. And then, you know, the other affidavit about the different things that were going on, which, you know, again, with WWE, especially in that era, you know, it's been kind of like, what would I say? You know, I mean, the you know, when you're talking about that mid-2000s era, there were all those rumors that were going around. At the same time, it was one of those things that was always alleged to be happening in Hollywood and everywhere. And kind of like those standards, you know, today it's, you know, again, I'm not defending it even then at all. Not one bit. But it was kind of just kind of boys will be boys back then. And today, you know, it's people kind of look at it very differently, as they should. And it's become kind of it's just a lot of stuff to really digest, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot, a lot going on there. And I think one of the really interesting things about the Grant lawsuit is that it is leading people to revisit some of the stuff that has been out there with a new eye, or new information is coming to light. And that's great, because in the really big picture here, we're talking about, you know, abuse of women, abuse of employees, people working under bad conditions. To me, all of that needs to be reexamined, not just to find out what happened and kind of get accountability for it and hear people's stories, but because when you look at institutions where things like this have happened, if that isn't brought to light, what tends to happen is the institution becomes extremely self-protective. It finds scapegoats, it puts them out there, and it doesn't learn the lessons it needs to have abuse not perpetuated in the future. So I do think it's really important to be looking back at things like this. And over the last few days, I've been talking to people in the business, in part about things that were going on back then. And a consistent theme is yeah, it was really wild. And I look back and I wonder how, you know, how that kind of persisted, and, you know, finding answers to that does feel important.
I mean, when we look about it, this was a, you know, again, the nature of the business, because I mean, number one, it was not really sports and not really entertainment. It kind of flew below the radar until recent years, and as far as mainstream media coverage, I think that's part of it. So they were kind of certainly like this insular world where they could pretty much, again with Vince was the king of this world, and he could do whatever he wanted, and he had plenty of people to, you know, cover up his mess. You know, whatever he was going to do, he was very confident it could be covered up, and it allowed things to persist. And I mean, it's kind of fascinating to watch people when they start showing old clips of things that, you know, again, I just remember certain things we would be in the news with Vince. And then like a week or two later on Raw, we would see them sort of revisited in this weird way that was like defending Vince, you know, from false allegations that were, you know, and apparently with the benefit of hindsight, a lot of them were true. And I think that, you know, but the fact that he would just blatantly do that on his own television show, like as his own TV show at times, was his what's it called, like his catharsis, I think, you know. He would script things on the TV having to do with his frustrations in life.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably one reason some of this stuff hasn't come in for the mainstream scrutiny. It might have, because if you're, you know, I'm a long time wrestling fan, long time observer reader, certainly doesn't make me an expert or anything like that. But I think I do have a bit of an understanding of how blurry that line between reality and fiction is. And one of the interesting things in the new statement from Ashley Massaro is she's explaining how the scripting of your on-screen character can be a tool used against the real life performer.
The pressure on you right there on screen to, I would say, acquiesce, if that's the right word, but to certainly toe the line. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's that can be a very difficult thing, I think, for people who don't have some familiarity with wrestling to understand. You might sound like a crazy person saying, oh, well, he retaliated against her for rejecting his advances by scripting this or that. And somebody might say, well, it's like an actor. What does it matter? How does that affect them? You know, that's the job. You do the scripts that are written for you. And to some extent, that's fair, and to a large extent, that really misses the reality of what goes on in wrestling,
and a lot of the pressures that are on the performers. I mean, when you look at the, you know, there's always pressures on all the performers, but the pressures on the women performers now, and even far more then, were very different than the male performers. The male performers had to be able to do promos; they had to be able to, you know, wrestle at a certain level. Back then, it was for the women; it was how you looked. And there was this feeling that, you know, look, we've got, you know, all these different people from the Diva Search every year that we can bring in, and they're all really good looking. And not that they're interchangeable, but largely we can replace you at the stamp of a finger, even if you're popular, which happened to people. So it becomes kind of a thing of, you know, don't piss off the boss. And I saw something, you know, where like Francine, you know, mentioned something, I think, on her podcast. She talked a lot, actually, this week, on different aspects of, like, you know, just, you know, kind of getting the advice that, like, oh, if something happens, just say that you're ill rather than actually turn down, and you'll be, you know what I mean? Like, oh, I'm not feeling good type of a mm-hmm. thing is a lot smarter, kind of like advice if somebody hits on you. And it's kind of, you know, and it's the pressure on those women, you know, was very, very large in a very different way than guys can understand. And this come, you know, I think from today's standpoint, the one thing that everybody is kind of looking at is, okay, we know about Vince, and Vince is gone. Okay. But it's like, exactly who should be held accountable and how much, in the sense of, did people know that this was going on? And it's like, certainly from a rumor standpoint, everybody did, or many, many did. And from a insider standpoint, there were those who knew more than others, you know, more, they were more part of the inner circle. And who were they? They still were not going to be people who would cross Vince, because they were there because they didn't cross Vince. But how responsible should there be? And there was a culture, which is the key thing, and that you brought up. It's like, there was a culture there, and that culture is a big part of the problem. Vince was a large part of shaping the culture, but the people around were all part of the culture. How culpable should they be? And that's a really hard question, which I've still been like trying to wrap my head around.
Yeah, it's a terribly difficult question to answer. So everyone I've talked to, and I'm sure you know much more than me, has described a system in some level of awareness. Were they aware of the sorts of things in the Chanel Grant lawsuit? No. Did they see Vince making out with divas in the locker room the way Ashley Massaro said she did? No. But there was definitely some level of awareness that at the least Vince was, you know, having or pursuing inappropriate relationships with people who work for him. The same way in the suit, there is at the least, you know, there is alleged a level of awareness from a number of upper executives that at the least, Vince had his girlfriend on the payroll in a fake job. There was some awareness. And you get to this question of what did they know and what should be done about that? And that's so difficult in part because the company was so controlled by Vince McMahon to the point where even after he resigned due to information about the NDAs and sexual coercion being alleged came out in the Wall Street Journal, he was still able to march back in and take over the company, as we know. So it's not to excuse anybody, but I think to start answering that question, you have to acknowledge that people, even with the best of intentions and who may have had some awareness, weren't necessarily in a position to do anything about it other than go public with allegations that they couldn't necessarily prove. And that's a lot to ask of people. I think in a general sense, you have to put more accountability for that on people who are higher up in the food chain, who knew more and who were better in a position to do that if their conscience demanded it. If somebody is, if they're a kind of rank and file wrestler, it's asking a lot of them to step away and denounce this when you're talking about their ability to pay their mortgage, save for retirement, save to put their kids through school. Whereas obviously there are, you know, people who were making a lot more money and had a lot more the independents who, if they were aware of this and chose not to say anything about it, I think that should be probably looked on a little more harshly. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, it's just such a hard thing because I think a lot of people want answers, and there's certain names that come out, obviously, like Paul Levesque and Nick Khan. Like, mm-hmm. What did they know? Should they be there? And what we do know about them is that, you know, they voted not to have him back, and Dan Paul's his son-in-law doing that. And then a week later, they completely flipped. And you had, and I mean, I think that this, you know, when it happened, it was a big deal. But even now, I think it's much bigger when you look at these board members who all resigned rather than flip. So, right. So that tells you how strongly they must have felt, because the board thing is, you know, it's a good position to be in, you know, with the stock options and everything like that.
Well, Dave, you even had the Bruce Pritchard quote in the Observer today, where he explained why he can't say anything. And the last line that you had was because he could lose his job.
Well, of course. I mean, if he said the wrong thing, of course he would. And look, I don't think anyone expects anyone in there to say something damning. You know, the only person I would say from like what I would call the inner circle who said anything of substance would be Laurinaitis through his lawyer. And that's all, you know, in his case, it's largely self-protection because he knows he's in a lot of trouble. And his reputation's destroyed already. And, you know, so he's just trying to, you know, put as much blame on Vince as he can to deflect. And most people aren't buying it. But in doing so, you know, I mean, he certainly, to me, was one of the key people in taking this Ashley Massaro story and putting it in a new light, because when it first came out, it's like her word against the entire company. I mean, like, it wasn't just they released that statement. They had the people on the tour, you know, everyone on the tour but one, you know, basically going through and telling people it's not true, it's not true, it's not true. I mean, they fought hard on that because it's a really nasty allegation. And then it comes out, you know, and I guess you brought it up and you know, I mean, when Paul London said things, it's one thing, but when Rios, the doctor, you know, said, yes, you know, she told me. And when I went to Laurinaitis, he said he knew. I mean, that puts it in a complete, that changes the credibility quotient a great deal.
And I mean, absolutely. And that's one thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, is just the credibility here, because that was one thing that surprised me when I started looking into the story and reviewing what people had said on different podcasts or the like, was how much it all locked together a little bit. And this has been a bit of an odd story to cover, because usually when you're covering a story about sexual misconduct, people aren't going to want to talk about it for good reasons. Maybe they're witnesses in an ongoing investigation. Maybe they're targets of an ongoing investigation. Most people have every reason not to say anything. But in this case, because these are these are very public figures and there's a lot of interest in these stories among wrestling fans, people who had direct knowledge of this stuff had, it turned out, been talking about these things for years, in some cases without getting much attention paid to it, because there's a lot of interviews people give. But the Rios interview, and I don't say this with any disrespect whatsoever to the reporters or the producers of the Ashley v. WWE Audible podcast that came out last fall. I don't know if they realized exactly the significance of what Rios said, or that it contradicted the WWE denial of everything. They certainly didn't emphasize it in the episode, but he was plainly saying not only that he was aware of it, but that he had reported it to John Laurinaitis, and that John Laurinaitis had told him he was already aware of it. And that is really important to me because, as you say, Laurinaitis and his lawyer have, and I say this without casting any doubt on what they're saying, but they have a motive to make WWE look bad or Vince McMahon to look bad out of self-exculpatory motives. The fact that what Rio says lines up with what Laurinaitis says, and then it's further corroborated by things Paul London had said, it all really fits together. And yeah, I'm not comfortable generally saying people lied.
Somebody did.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that the best possible construction you could put on WWE's denial is that whoever put out that statement didn't know what actually went on. And I don't buy that. I think it was a cover-up. And that is really...
It's a cover-up of something really big.
Really, really big.
Yeah.
And something that's crucial. This is crucial to me because one of the things that we reported was that hadn't been previously reported was that the Navy actually did an investigation into Massaro's claims.
Yeah.
And that we don't know for a fact. We're still waiting for the investigative files to come in. But that started the month after Massaro died. And that would indicate to me that they started looking into it because that affidavit was published after her death.
Right.
So we don't know what the result of that is going to be. It could back her story. It could refute her story, or they could say 13 years had passed since this happened. We couldn't find out anything one way or the other. I don't know, but two things that are significant to me there are that in the denial, WWE originally said that if they had been aware of this, they would have reported this to the base commander, which it doesn't seem they did. There was only an investigation opened after her death. So I would have a hard time believing they actually did that, even though they said that's what they would have done. And the other bit about it, I just lost my train of thought. So I'll stop there. There's a lot of significant stuff there.
I actually do have a question that is probably for the both of you, but as I'm reading through the Ashley Massaro story, she is consistently saying that she does not want anybody to know what happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming somewhat because of pro wrestling being sort of this closed space that Dave and I, we talked about last week about the kayfabe of it all and such. And then also because, and Tim and I were talking about this before we actually started recording, I started watching the Bill Cosby documentary, which I stayed away from for a long time, but thought that because of this situation that we're talking about almost every week, I really needed to watch it. And there was a very strategic psychological thing that he would do to these women after they realized what happened, and it would basically create shame for them, which stopped them from telling anybody or coming at him. And in reading Vince holding these meetings supposedly with Ashley and saying, well, you know, we can't undo this goodwill we've done with the military and X, Y, and Z, he's essentially putting the responsibility on her in bringing down the company or putting out bad words about the company. And I guess I just wonder, like, how do people come forward if they have information with sort of this closed environment of what pro wrestling is, and B, I mean, there's got to be some, you know, some thoughts about if I talk about this, you know, I'm bringing something back up that could be a really negative memory back to the forefront.
Not just negative memory, but also the, you know, there's a thing that's instilled in people, you know, about protecting the business above yourself. And, you know, like one thing that I found really interesting in the whole Massaro thing was, you know, she made those statements, you know, the all the statements you've reported and the original statement that came out years ago. And I read it. And when you look at it, they ring really true, especially the rape story, because others close to her have corroborated aspects of that story. You know, her best friend was on Ashley Banfield this week and, you know, kind of, you know, said, yeah, I knew all this. She told me all this. And it wasn't like I could go in there, and I even did in this week's issue. I kind of mentioned, like, this isn't exactly perfect with what she said, but it's like 95-98% similar. And those 2% that a lawyer would go after are very obviously things that 17 years ago, you're not going to have a perfectly aligned story. So when I bring it up, it's just to basically to tell people, like, look, this is the little openings that they're giving you, but it's 17 years, and to jump on those and forget about the other 97% is kind of bullshit, right? So, but the thing with her is she did write that letter to WWE apologizing years later. And I think it's like that, whether it was she was wanting a job back or whether it was something of, oh my God, this lawyer got me to say stuff and I said stuff bad about the company. And there was still, like, after all this, you could see this weird loyalty to a company that had no care for her whatsoever. And that, you know, again, like, tried to, you know, their only thing was to protect themselves and protect themselves publicly. And her and what happened to her was not a major thing to them, obviously, because they were just making sure that, you know, they got plenty of goodwill working with the service. And then this thing could explode on everyone. And the most important thing is to pretend it never happened from all concerns. And I think in her mind, like, what she was thinking, I don't know, but it's like, you know, I look at that and it's like, she still had that loyalty that's installed of, you don't say anything bad. And, oh my God, I got coerced into saying something bad. But now, in years later, when we look at it and what she's told other people, it all lines up. So she was like, that's like just the level of the, I don't know if it's called the mind games or whatever, that are involved in this profession and at that level.
Yeah, there's a lot that's just come up that I'd like to talk about. So I want to backtrack for one second and just talk about people coming forward. It's very difficult. I've covered a lot of stories involving sexual misconduct or sexual violence, and it can be intensely re-traumatizing just to discuss that. There are fears that I think sometimes people don't think about, especially when we're talking about public figures, because we think of them as these larger than life people we see on TV, and we think about them in connection to these things we know about them, but they're just people. Do you want to go public with this knowing it might do some good, or it might help preventing this from happening to someone else, when you also know that your parents, your neighbors, your kids are going to know that this happened to you? That's a very difficult question to answer for a lot of people. And a lot of people feel conflict over that, even when they have decided they want to come forward. And that's without all these other complexes that you're talking about how you're trained to protect the business. And you might have some feelings of guilt. If I do this, is this going to harm the livelihoods of people I care about a lot, especially at the time a lot of this was going on, when, not to make this a labor issue and certainly not to make it any issue about WWE versus AEW or anything, but I've talked to a couple of people recently who have brought up that at the time we're discussing, it was a monopoly business. You were going to work for WWE, or you were going to work in the indies. There wasn't really anywhere else to go. Japan was down. You're not going to make that money in Mexico
at all.
It was take it or leave it. And so that plays into it. The letter that she Before I want to get to that letter, but one thing that I'm really struck by looking back is that everything you'd look for if you were covering a story like this is there. Like, basically, when my colleagues and I are looking into a story about this kind of misconduct, one of the things you're looking for is, did they tell other people? Is there any kind of contemporaneous documentation, or do people remember them talking about it? Not that you necessarily need to have that to make somebody's story true, but it helps if you're thinking about, how do I verify this? How do I document it? It's pretty consistent from a lot of people that she told them or talked to them, because they were aware of it without her knowledge or consent, about this happening after she got back to the States from Kuwait. That's very clear. This is not a case of she never told anybody and then this mysterious document came out after she died. She clearly talked about this to many people and described it consistently to them. And that makes the story quite a bit more credible. I think you'd have a real hard time poking holes in her from that angle. The letter is a little bit weird to me, and I do wish I'd mentioned that in the first story I did about this. WWE released it, and they released what they said were excerpts. So it's right. hard to know the whole context.
But at least I did try to get the whole letter without success.
And you weren't able to succeed. When I've asked WWE about some of the stuff, I didn't ask them particularly about this letter, but their kind of general line right now is, oh, that was in the past. We don't have anybody here who knows about that stuff, the stuff related events, which is, oh, see if you believe that or not. But at least in what they released, she didn't recant anything in the affidavit. It wasn't her saying, I made these stories up or nothing like that at all. She was saying she regretted getting involved in the suit. And there are a number of reasons you could regret getting involved in the suit. It might be because the lawsuit, with all respect to the lawyers involved, turned out to be kind of a fiasco. It didn't really go anywhere. Constantine Kuros, the lead lawyer in the suit, was, he was fined hundreds of thousands of dollars for his conduct. He had apparently appropriated from an NFL concussion suit without even changing verbiage.
Yeah.
And it was just not a well done suit. I would think that a more sophisticated legal approach might well have won damages. I think that if you look at the NFL precedent, there's probably a very strong case to be had for some sort of culpability in the case of people having traumatic brain injuries. But
one of the things I want to bring up on that just really quick is that the law, as it was pertained to Connecticut at the time, had like a statute of limitations that almost, it's like for a concussion lawsuit, the law itself was just, it's like if you have a broken arm, I mean, there's like a thing of like, well, 15 years later, you can't go back for it. But the thing with the brain injury and why that law is ridiculous, you know, I mean, I talked to McDivitt a lot about this one, and he didn't like what my conclusion was, which is essentially, yes, based on the law, you know, it's like most of the cases were so far back in time of those wrestlers that the statute of limitations had run out. And my argument was that it's a bad law. And he goes, we can only go by the law. And this is the law. And it's like, you're right, this is the law. I didn't say that the judge was wrong, but this is a really bad law when it comes to concussions, because the concussions you have in your 30s, you may not find the effects of your brain damage until you're 70.
Right.
You don't even know. You don't even know. And I mean, there is a whole crew of wrestlers, past and present, who studied from the Chris Benoit period and know that they've had concussions. And I know from many of them as they got older, and I'm sure that the ones today that are in their 40s are scared when they're in their 60s, because we know we got our bell rung a couple of times and we were in a fog for a day or two and continued to wrestle, of course. But what does this mean when we're 65 or 70 and you've seen some of the NFL players and you've seen the Vern Gagne's and the Nick Bockwinkles at the end of their lives and things like that? And it's like, oh my God, this is such a horrible thing. And so anyway, I didn't want to get diverged into the concussion thing, but the law as it pertains to statute of limitations on concussions is you know, or injury should not relate to concussions. It's a very bad law. And that's, you know, the suit itself was a badly written suit, but even a well-written suit, while there is a case there, the problem is that the law is, when it comes to this, is just very bad. Although the NFL, you know, obviously, you know, the NFL situation was different and there were damages, you know, that were large amount of damages that were.
Yeah. It's just, it's a super naughty kind of litigation in the best circumstances. You have to find the right jurisdiction, all this stuff. And so I just wanted to put that out there because I imagine there are people who are aware of that letter and might say, oh, well, you know, doesn't this mean she took it all back? And no, that's not the case, unless WWE wants to provide the full letter and it does say something like that, in which case, you know, we can look at that, but it doesn't sound like they've provided it to you. Or
I would think that if that was in the letter, that would have been in the excerpts that they released.
Yeah, you would assume they would yes, want to get that out there.
Yeah. Okay. So getting back, so the whole thing with the situation is it does put a new light on it, and I think it's a very, you know, it's a sad story, but at the same time, the whole mindset of that period, and it's still there. It's different, but I mean, there's, you know, again, there's pressure on women to, you know, obviously look a certain way, and you know, now, I mean, the women performers are, by the heads of WWE, are clearly valued more than they were in the mid-2000s. And the talent level, obviously, for what they do, you know, is a lot more like wrestling than it was in the mid-2000s. But, you know, a lot of the people from the mid-2000s are still there, or were there very recently. And so some of them are still there. And it becomes that question of, you know, I mean, I know there's people who want a house cleaning, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to go like, okay, you know, like, what did they know? What kind of power did they have? These are unanswered questions. I'm not saying that you should or shouldn't do it. I'm just saying these are very troubling questions.
I mean, do we know if there's been any talk of investigation or, you know, digging through all that stuff from the company perspective, from the TKO perspective?
We haven't seen any evidence of it. And I mean, everything that I've seen from the TKO and the Area Manual perspective is, you know, profits. And, you know, these guys had a long leash. I mean, he obviously, for whatever reason, you know, I mean, he wanted Vince in a bad, bad way, enough to choose a deal to keep him. And, you know, and again with Dana, you know, I mean, you know, the Dana stuff is public. I mean, he didn't even get a slap on the wrist as far as we know.
I wouldn't only say I haven't seen any evidence that they've done some sort of investigation or might be looking into one. I don't know if they really understand the question, to be honest. One of the first things I wanted to get an answer from TKO and WWE about when the lawsuit came out that I haven't gotten a really good answer to is whether they were looking into not just NDAs that Vince McMahon had signed. And that's a whole other rat nest, the NDAs themselves. One of the things I reported was that WWE, its own lawyers, hadn't looked at them. They were kind of secretly done on the side. That raises its own issues.
Yeah, a lot.
Which is, like, there's a lot going on there, even possibly from a shareholder perspective.
There's another one, which is, okay, we know the NDAs that have to do with, you know, women who complained about being sexually harassed, right? But we also know that there are many, many NDAs there, you know, whether it's former writers or whatever, mm-hmm. people that where you can't say anything. And some of that may be related to covering up things. I mean, I'm not exactly. Like, you know, it's like those, it's not so, like there was four or five NDAs signed. There have been, you know, I mean, many people have come forward and go, yeah, there's NDAs involved. And what, you know, so it's like there may be people in this specific case who know, whether it's Chanel Grant or others, who know a lot, and they were, you know, there's, you're kind of paid off to keep your mouth shut type of a thing.
Right. And that's one thing I'm very curious about is whether they'll do a blanket release, which they absolutely have the authority to release people from NDAs signed directly with WWE. And they haven't said they'll do that, but they also haven't said they won't do that. So one of the things I wanted to know was, have they been looking for women who didn't sign NDAs? Because I have a very hard time believing that everybody who's made an accusation of misconduct against Vince McMahon has had one of these NDAs signed, or that there were only five women who did. And basically the impression I get is they're like, well, you know, you can't call everyone in America asking them if they have an accusation against Vince McMahon. We'll deal with stuff as it comes up, which is on the one hand fair, but on the other hand, doesn't suggest that they're really interested in looking into the full scope of the problem. And that comes up with the Massaro stuff we're talking about, because it's an entirely different problem. It's obviously very distinctly related in that there we're talking in both cases about misconduct against women by Vince McMahon, awareness of it by people around him, that complex of issues. But the significance of the previously unpublished statement from Massaro to me is that for all the rumors and for all that, I think this has pretty generally been known that this is how Vince McMahon operates. Like a friend of mine who covers these sorts of issues asked me the other day, she was like, why is this such a big deal? Like, we've known this about Vince McMahon forever. And she's someone who doesn't care at all about wrestling. It was funny to hear that. And it was a totally fair point to make. But basically what Massaro is outlining is a casting couch scheme.
Yeah.
And that would present, I would think, at least the potential for litigation from anybody who is subject to it. I haven't really looked into that question specifically on what the statutes of limitation around that are, but they're from any number of angles, from a basic, we want to know what happened here, so we want to prevent it again, or we want to find out what happened here, so if there are people working at the company who are complicit about this, we can move them out, or we want to know what our exposure is. There doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in that. And that's one reason I'm certainly continuing to pursue the story. I know other reporters are. This isn't just a matter of interest in what's happened and what people's experiences have been working for this company. It very directly bears on kind of corporate governance. Are they looking into this and trying to figure out who might have culpability and figure out what to do about them, whether there does need to be a house cleaning, or are they just trying to get past the PR nightmare and say, McMahon and Laurinaitis are gone now, everything's fine, no one's subjected to this kind of behavior. And that's without even getting into the kind of more wrestling specific questions that I kind of personally doubt Ari Emanuel is thinking about all that much. Like, even if things have changed a lot for the better from 20 years ago, and by all accounts they have, you still have a whole generation of male and female wrestlers, and at this point, coaches and trainers, people who came up in that system and kind of think of that as normal.
Yeah.
What would it, if you did hypothetically say, want to do a house cleaning and we're going to get rid of all these people who have years and years and years of experience in this job because they turn a blind eye and we don't want that in our company, who do you bring in to replace them? What does the new system look like? This isn't a financial services company where if you fire 100 people, you can go hire another 100 people who've done pretty much the same jobs. It's not to say that like anybody is irreplaceable, because everybody can be replaced. But gosh, if you got rid of all the institutional knowledge in WWE, I imagine you have a very hard time filling those positions. And so that's even more incentive for TKO and WWE to kind of just say, it was a Vince problem, and Vince isn't here anymore, and everybody knows we're not going to tolerate this sort of thing. So like, let's move on and see if Cody finishes the story, mm-hmm. which is a big, you know, a big, they have every reason to say that, especially when there are a lot of fans who don't want to hear about all this stuff.
Well, to Tim's point, Jennifer Pepperman recently left the writing team, right? I wonder if it is in their exit interviews to ask ask certain questions about why, or, you know, anything related to being uncomfortable or anything about that. Cause that would tell you that is something that they are interested in finding more about the culture in the company.
It's an excellent question. I would love to know the answer to that, because at most corporate jobs, you are going to have an exit interview and say, what's been working, what's not been working, what would you change for the better? it would be fascinating to know if they're even asking, particularly women who might be leaving the company.
You know, the one thing is, and I guess I've been curious about this, if nothing else, is exactly like the timeline, so to speak, in the sense that, okay, we all know essentially when whoever this anonymous person was that went to the board at first, which triggered everything. So we know when that was, and we know that the board members were aware of something, whether they believed it or not at first. There was an awareness that it was there, and it wouldn't have been hard because it would have only taken about a second because they would have known the name, and they would have known the name did work for the company until recently. So they would know that much, and they didn't really, I mean, it's like, I guess that they did an investigation, but they didn't really do anything. And there was really nothing that we heard whatsoever until the Wall Street Journal broke the story. And then when they broke it, when they continued on the story with more and more information from whether it was, I mean, it always felt to me like they had a knowledge of what that board knew, which is very hard to get, but they had that. And I mean, the one thing that I noticed from day one of the Wall Street Journal story and afterwards that really hit me was there was no fire back by McDivitt. There was no fire back by WWE. I mean, in the past, in that same situation, I mean, I would hear from McDivitt the next day and it's all lies and blah, blah, blah. And when I didn't, it's like, he's not firing back. This story's got to be really true because it's really devastating and they're not even defending it. So that was a real, you know, that was a real scary thing, I think, when that came out. But like the depths of what she wrote in the lawsuit, I mean, what did they know? What did the board know? And Levesque and Nick Khan obviously are both on the board. Stephanie was as well. Did they know only the basics, the broad-based stuff that was in the Wall Street Journal articles, or did they know, and why would they not know if there was an investigation of, you know, the Laurinaitis situation and the
right.
The alleged situation when it came to the other things in the lawsuit? Were they blindsided by the lawsuit, or were they aware? And that's the thing that's really troubling. Like when Levesque on that night, when he just goes like, I didn't read the lawsuit, which was kind of like, wait a minute, you know, you're an executive with the company. This is a giant, giant thing. It's your father-in-law. It's your job to know at least the basics of this. So it was, but it's like, when did those people know, especially like when Vince came back and Nick did his, tour, you know, after one of the TV deals, I think it was, and he's just going around telling everyone, oh yeah, I always knew he was going to be back. It was just a vacation to recharge or whatever. And it's kind of like, there's a lot more than that.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm equally fascinated by that as I am about who might have leaked. And I make no assumptions about that because I know in my own reporting, and I know you've talked about this, Dave. You'd always be surprised. People think they know and they don't know.
I never speculate because I know that. And the reason I never speculate about, you know, specifics on that is because I know from myself that people always do.
Yeah.
And I will not say that they're 100% wrong, but they're usually 90-95% wrong.
But we do know it was obviously somebody with very privileged access to very confidential
information. A lot of knowledge. Yeah.
That's what we know.
Yeah.
But part of when I think about the question of who knew, it strikes me that the extremity and the depravity of the allegations in the suit can kind of distract from the fact that even if they literally just knew what the Wall Street Journal reported, that was more than enough to say this guy cannot come back to the company.
Yeah.
If you are the billionaire owner of a publicly traded company and you're putting your girlfriend on the payroll in a fake job, that's a huge problem in its own right. Even if it's all consensual, even if, you know, none of the things that are alleged in the suit are part of it at all, that's not okay. And there seems to have been this kind of, no one's exactly articulated this, but this tacit defense of, we knew there were some allegations, we didn't know exactly how bad they were. And it's like, if you read the Wall Street Journal, which I know you do, you would have known that there was stuff here that should have had him out of the company entirely. And so the whole defense of like, oh, we didn't really know, which is kind of implicit in what they're saying, I don't really buy that. You're okay with that kind of relationship, because that's inherently coercive. There's such a power disparity there, and it's so inappropriate for an executive to be doing that.
Well, so here's another thing, and so there is a person, because one of the things in that, and this was not in the lawsuit, this was actually from the Wall Street Journal, but the lawsuit sort of went into detail, not the financial aspect, but I remember one of the Wall Street Journal stories was, okay, she's starting out at whatever, 75,000 a year as entry level or whatever. And then as the relationship goes, Vince wants to put her as a VP at 400 with, like, you know, no experience whatsoever. I mean, that's what Vince wants. And he made that decision. He's the owner. And then someone went to him, and that's just, which is a really, you know, interesting thing just that it happened, and who this person is, we don't know, and said to Vince, it's like, Vince, this looks bad. So he's got to know there's a reason this looks bad. And the compromise was she got a raise to 200 and she got a director job instead of a VP job. But it's like, he was ready to go and make her a VP of the company. I mean, that's how, you know, I mean, you know, that's kind of mind blowing that he almost did that, and he had to be talked out of it. But the key is that somebody did talk him out of that, and that person had to have known, you know, a lot, right?
You would think so. And whether an interesting question is whether that person would have been one of the four executives named in the lawsuit or a different person.
Yeah.
That's where it's at least potentially the case that this knowledge becomes more widespread than we know. And I ultimately think we're going to get answers to a lot of that, because just to kind of lay things out for listeners who might not be familiar, the next step in the case, I think as soon as today, I haven't checked the docket since we've been on the call, so it might actually have happened, but the lawyers for McMahon and Laurinaitis and the WWE are supposed to either put in some kind of response to the complaint or file for an extension, which I would guess is pretty likely here. But barring a settlement, which the tea leaves don't seem to indicate right now, at least, they're going to go through the whole process of discovery and deposition.
That's devastating, though.
Yeah, and if that happens, then Grant's lawyers, they can ask for emails, text messages, contents of phones. They put out, I've had this happen to me as a defendant over a frivolous defamation suit. It's like imagine a root canal lasting months. They can go through, you know, they put out a document called a document hold, and it's just, you are going to be severely penalized if you lose your phone or all your emails accidentally get deleted. They get to go through everything, and they get to use that material, sitting down, asking these executives, asking pretty much anyone they want from WWE. It's a defendant. What did you know? Who did you talk to? Explain this email. Explain this text message. What did you mean by that? Why did you sign off on hiring this person? Why did you sign off on promoting this person? Did you know of any inappropriate? Every question that WWE wouldn't want answered. And then, after that process, they can move to say the facts are the law is so clear here that we shouldn't even have to have a trial. You can go to summary judgment. Both sides can put that in. That's a long, drawn out process where the idea someone might have from just reading the complaint that these people are going to kind of remain unnamed, or that people who haven't even been brought up in the complaint are safe. It's not like that at all. If the case just keeps proceeding, and discovery is called discovery because you're discovering things, to be really, you know, straightforward about it, there may be lots of people who knew who the lawyers have no idea of, and they're going to find out. It's the potential is there for this to get even, it can't really get any uglier than it is, but for
more detailed though.
Yeah. Lots more detail about who knew. And that's why I would have to imagine that if they have their say, the TKO WWE side will just hand over a blank check and say, we do not want to go through
that. They don't want to go through discovery. Look with the MLW suit, they, you know, the minute it was going to go to discovery, that's when it ended. But so the thing here is, there's another thing. There's a federal investigation going on as mm-hmm. well. which is, you know, now we're talking about criminal, potential criminal charges. And then the other aspect is again, and I don't know, I mean, I have seen Ann Callis on podcasts and on television, and I have looked up, you know, her background and everything. And I think that this is, I think that she as a lawyer is very unique as compared to most of the lawyers who've gone after WWE. It's just a, it's a gut feeling I have, but it is, it's just, like I, and again, it's up to, in the end, it's going to be up to the client and everything like that. And certainly the, you know, insurance company may pressure a settlement as much as TKO, hard. But I also think that she feels, and again, every lawyer outwardly will do this anyway, but I feel a little stronger with her in the sense of she's going to want to go the distance maybe more than another lawyer who may be in the situation going like, hey.
So I really strongly agree with that. It's a gut sense. I'm not going to try to represent her side or speak for her. And ultimately it's clear this is on the client. It's Grant's case. But right. That said, she does have a background in class action. She has talked about hearing from many, many more people who have claims to make. And crucially to me, a lot of the lawsuit is actually concerned with the NDA. So from what we know, from what they allege, the NDA is signed. Vince makes the first payment. He decides he doesn't have to make the second payment. Presumably, we don't know this, but presumably because information about it has come out in the Wall Street Journal. So he says she didn't hold up her side, which may not even be true. It may be that she told a friend before signing it, like, these are all the things that happened to me and they're giving me $3 million. I haven't signed it yet, but that's what's happening. And then this friend emails the board. We have no idea what happened there, but it's entirely possible that she kept to the NDA and just didn't get paid. So on its face, the NDA would not seem to hold because he didn't sign up his part of the contract. But they don't just say that the NDA isn't valid because of that. They go further and say it should be voided because basically of non-specificity. The idea that the language about, and I talked to a bunch of experts about this, the language in a contract like this is generally going to be pretty specific. Like a good example is if you work at Apple and you work on the iPhone and you leave, you will sign an NDA upon leaving and they're going to give you, you know, broad but fairly tailored language about you can't go across the street to Google and tell them how we build an iPhone or, you know, whatever engineering project you're working on. That's proprietary information. That's what you're not allowed to talk about. And we'll sue the hell out of you and Google if you go over and give them that information. This, the contract in the suit is super, super broad to the point where if you read it at face value, she couldn't put WWE on her resume. It doesn't actually define what she's supposed to keep secret. So they're basically arguing, saying the contract is inherently invalid because it doesn't define what the contract is about. This is a leap of inference, but pretty much everyone I've talked to has said it's a reasonable guess to make for right now, is that this would be a boilerplate NDA, and thus that the other NDAs that Vince would have signed would look like this. So if this one was invalidated, you could probably guess the other ones would be. So I find that really interesting. And, you know, as I've stressed here, this is on the basis of a couple of inferences and guesses, but my guess would be that they want to get those NDAs invalidated in part so that if other women who have signed them do choose to come forward or choose to sue, they can do so with precedent right there, or they can do so with assurance that a court has already found this language is overly broad. So if you add all that up with her background and just what you're looking at in the suit, yeah, this does not at all strike me as a case where they're looking to get the maximum payout for the one client. I'm sure they're going to represent their client in accordance with her best interests and look to see if she's well represented, but they certainly seem to be set up for the long haul and possibly to bring more people in either in this suit or with similar suits. And God, I mean, as you know better than anybody, that's not even a can of worms. That's a case of can of worms. And with the criminal investigation, there's kind of a similar dynamic in that. So The Wall Street Journal reported that the feds are looking into a number of things. One of them is sex trafficking, which is, you know, commercial sex act by force, fraud, or coercion, which the allegations in the suit, at least on their face, would seem to satisfy. So there's definitely some potential criminal jeopardy there. But when you have this kind of grand jury investigation, it can go in any direction the evidence leads. And, you know, 30 years ago, Vince McMahon was involved in a serious child molestation scandal that the FBI looked into. I mean, the directions that a federal probe could go in are also just really endless. They could, you know, who knows? Like, all that stuff is on the table. And that's one of the big mysteries to me, especially because in my experience covering that kind of federal probe, they're really tight. You can find out stuff about them because sometimes people who've been interviewed by investigators will talk about it, or you can get inferential evidence like that. But you don't really know. Maybe they look into all this stuff and they say, it's too complicated. It's not worth the bother. We got other priorities. You know, I'm certainly not sitting here saying anything in particular is going to happen to Vince McMahon or anyone else, but the potential is there for something that's just almost unbelievably sprawling. And we may not have any indicators of that for, you know, quite a while. They keep things secret, and the FBI is pretty serious about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is there's that, the potential's hanging over everyone's head. And then there's, you know, I mean, from a TKO standpoint, the other thing is, this is totally unrelated, but the Kung Lee trial date coming soon, is a potential, it's another devastating lawsuit with potential against the company, the TKO company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and as mentioned before, if that lawsuit is successful, it opens up an identical lawsuit against WWE, because from a business standpoint, the UFC company and the way they operate, as a, you know, not monopoly, but dominant company that has done many, many things to keep other companies down. It's actually stronger with WWE than with UFC. You know, I mean, as far as, I never heard of UFC keeping people out of arenas. WWE was, you know, part, you know, it was their culture until probably just recently, and maybe even still exists. I don't know, but certainly existed a couple of years ago, because there were certainly arenas that just, from example, AEW couldn't go into, and it was just common knowledge. And then with the TV situation, which was what the MLW thing was, is, yeah, you know, like, they absolutely had exclusives with TV, and the NFL doesn't even do that. And the, you know, the UFC doesn't even do that for the very reason. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like that they're all, you know, fine with competition. No one is. Even the ones who say they are, they're not. But it's just like, there's just a lot of, you know, I mean, it's the TKO people. There's a lot on that's below the surface right now, but it's coming pretty close. That, again, maybe nothing will happen. Maybe they'll survive. But there's.
Yeah, I had somebody, and I wasn't talking to them about this because of any of this stuff with Janelle Grant or anything. It was just a friend of mine, but they were talking about the there's someone who'd have a pretty good perspective on this, and they were describing the Kung Lee lawsuit at this point as potentially existential for the UFC business model. And the things you were bringing up about WWE, I was going to ask you about if you have any insight into that. Because if anything, it would seem to apply more so to WWE, because at least UFC has a defense in terms of anti-competitive tactics. If they've had competition, the competition just hasn't been as good. There was Strikeforce, Bellator, you know, there's all these organizations. They haven't thrived, probably in part because of anti-competitive tactics from UFC, but also the UFC has just established itself as the, you know, the NFL of MMA, and good for them in that light. WWE has all those same things they're doing, but this long stretch of time where they did not have any competition, and they can't point to that as an out. They can't say, well, hey, if we were so bad, you know, how come all these other organizations have been trying to do it and hooked up with major media companies and they just haven't succeeded? So yeah, I you know, it's not the central thing here, because to me, the central thing is, what's alleged to have happened to Grant, what's alleged to have happened to other women who have been exploited, to men too, who have been in an exploitative system for all this time and whether they can find justice. But even though it's kind of outside of my ambit and what I'm reporting on, just a question I have about all this is, at what point does this start to look really kind of bad for Endeavor, for Ari Emanuel? You buy this box of radioactive waste. You don't know exactly how radioactive it is or how much waste is in the box, but you buy the box with other people's money. It explodes. There's radioactive waste all over the place. You have to pay for the cleanup. At what point are the people who gave you their money to invest going to start asking some questions about you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is when they purchased UFC, this lawsuit was already there. When they, you know, made the merger with WWE, it was after the Vince stuff was already out. You know, it's not like they got bombarded or they got blindsided, which could have happened, but that's not the timeline. The timeline is that they, doing due diligence, should have and had to have known about both. And for whatever reason, you know, whether they thought that it was frivolous and would go nowhere, you know, or you know, just it's so profitable it doesn't matter, which I think is the more likely scenario, which is that, like, look, these businesses are so freaking profitable and they're institutions now almost in our society. Not that they can't go down, because obviously bigger businesses than them historically have gone down, but they're pretty entrenched. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, some of the things that they counted on are not exactly happening, which is the continued escalation of TV rights fees. We are now finally seeing that may not continue to boom, but it certainly has not gone backwards either. But, you know, what they bought it for, which is these two companies that are very, very similar, can be operated by similar people, and both are number one in their field with a number two that's not close. And, you know, just giant, you know, keep salaries down. You know, the talent itself is paid, you know, again, compared to other sports, you know, far, far less by percentage. And in the case of the fighters, maybe not happy about it, but the fighters don't really have a lot of options. In the case of the wrestlers, they're actually, for the most part, happy about it, because in their minds, you know, $3 million a year, they're not thinking like an NBA player, you know, who thinks I deserve a lot more money than $3 million a year. For a wrestler, $3 million a year, it's like, you know, these guys, you know, especially the top ones, I mean, they spent 5-10 years making $50 a night, you know, or whatever it is, you know, on indies, and $3 million a year. Like, they never dreamed in their life that they would be in this position. So they're certainly not going to feel that they're exploited on money, even though from a technical sense, they are, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. They certainly are. It's one of the odd things about that business model to me. It's just that it's so, the value of the company is so, seems to me, reliant on the payroll being so low compared to basically any competitive enterprise, or even just the fact that, you know, as I understand the AEW business model, they're probably content with losing money year over year because they're growing the enterprise value. It's a startup. Like, that's a totally normal thing in business. But that they're trying to keep some kind of parity. They're not just spending like drunken sailors. And that as this much smaller company, they're still able to pay at or above WWE level should really be a red flag, right? Like, this company is over here doing whatever, 20% of the revenue, and they're able to pay more. Where's, you know, shouldn't the money that the athletes are generating be commensurate with the revenue the company has taken in? Why is this other company that's bringing in so much less able to pay at the same rates? You know, those are, again, existential questions I would have to imagine for that business model.
I mean, it's one of those things that's, you know, again, you know, is a Mercedes Moné situation, right? Where it's the perception, it's even a fan perception of the idea that I don't know her actual money demands, but I know in a general feeling what she was looking for from WWE, and, you know, kind of in the range. And for a star of her caliber, while it would be a little bit more than WWE would be generally paying her what she was looking for, or maybe even a little, you know, more than maybe even more than a little bit more, but it was not more than they pay other women in there, and she was one of their bigger stars. But the point of all this is that if AEW outbid for her, that tells you how, you know, when WWE has whatever it is, 8 times the revenue or whatever. Well, I think, you know, WWE's revenue is probably going to be about $1.4 billion, $1.3 billion, and AEW's is going to be about $170 million. So it's giant disparity. And yet when it comes to her, somehow AEW, which is, again, probably losing money, but it's not losing money to this point where they're, you know, again, like if the AEW losses were worrying them, we would see it because there'd be talent cut, you know, like when WWE had the pandemic and they cut everybody. AEW, if there's a mass cutting or there's all kinds of scaling backs and expenses, we'll go, okay, they're overspending and now they're worried. We haven't seen that in AEW. I think that they're, as far as like what the goal is and everything like that, I'm not saying it's perfect and exactly where they want to be, but it's not so bad that I see any signs of panic. And if they can afford a certain amount of money for Mercedes Moné that WWE says is exorbitant, you know, that's, I guess you could say WWE's done a good job of, you know, keeping expenses really low and profits really, really high. But I do find it funny when people bring that up and just go, oh my God, you know, she was asking for more than she was worth. Because if you look at it in a level of, you know, like what talent is, would be worth in almost any endeavor and certainly any sports endeavor, the number she was looking for was actually low because wrestlers have that, you know, they don't have the mentality of a, you know, star boxer or a mentality of a star football player or a star NBA player or NHL player because, you know, again, they've always been paid in comparison low, and most or many from fans or whatever think, isn't it great that you can do your dream job and actually make a lot of money? You know, and I guess we used to get that with baseball when I was a kid too. You know, it's like, how dare these guys ask for more than $25,000 a year? They're getting to play baseball. You know, that's, it should be fun. We all have to work, you know, not realizing that, you know, if what they're not paying are the profits that go to the owners or, you know, in, you know, in all of these basic situations, it's, you know, that, but that's another tangent, I suppose. But
yeah, but I guess I don't view it as a tangent, because these debates in sports are literally at this point, what, 50 years old, older than that?
60.
Yeah. I mean, we're going back to the 60s when Marvin Miller comes in baseball and we're having a lot of those. And I view these all as intimately linked to the kind of, exploitation that we're talking about of people who work for the company, of independent contractors, all of it. It's all a big ball of wax, and it's hard to grab any part of it just to look at that part, because it's so inherently tied to other things. Like even earlier when I was talking about one very valid reason someone might have for not wanting to be a whistleblower is just their own personal financial security, that of their family. If all these people were making money more in line with the revenue they generate, that would probably be somewhat of a different conversation. The same mechanisms that management uses to wring profits out of people are the same ones they can use to keep their own behavior covered up and hidden from the public. And if there's one good thing about all of this, it's that a lot more of that, I believe, is very likely to come out. And that can only be for the good of, you know, the talent and the athletes.
In the long run.
And that's good, even if it causes a lot of pain in the interim, which I don't mean to say lightly at all. It's not like there's a silver lining in this cloud. This is going to be ugly and play out in messy ways. But if this weird form of sports and entertainment is to join the 21st century, something like this has probably got to happen.
Yeah, you know, you're right. The one thing is that in the long run, when this is said and done, it will be infinitely better for, I'm not necessarily the profit losses of the owners, but the business itself for everybody else, for the talent in particular. It will be infinitely better if, you know, that, you know, that whole mentality of pure power of management over talent, and you know, especially when it comes to the women talent, you know, and the pressure on the women. Which is really, you know, again, it's extreme, but it was worse. you know, so whatever. But I mean, some of the stuff, I mean, even like if you like read like AJ Lee's book and, you know, and that stuff didn't even alarm people at the time. You know what I mean? And, but if you read it now by today's standards, you'd find a lot of alarming stuff in there.
I'll have to take a look at that. I haven't read it.
Yeah. Yeah. Things that she said about, you know, just like, you know, just words that were said. And I would know from words from, you know, people who were told by WWE that like, you know, and this is not now, this is another period of time that we're recruiting women. Now we are not, you know, before they had that period where they had the business deal with Playboy, and then they got out of the business deal with Playboy, probably for sponsorship reasons, I'm guessing. And then, but their thing is we're, even though we're not in business with Playboy, we want, you know, we want our women to look like they could be in Playboy. Mm. And that's a pretty harsh level, so to speak, because you're putting a lot of pressure on people, you know, especially, you know, once you get to 31, 32 years old, you want to keep your position. It's a pretty harsh standard for anyone, even 21. I shouldn't even use the age, but it's a harsh standard for a woman in her mind to live up to.
I just think about the cosmetic demands and how unforgiving it is, especially for women, as tough as it is for men to go out there in your underwear in front of millions of people.
Yeah.
Women have to, now that the standard of performance has been raised in WWE, which is a great, great thing. But you have to maintain this impossible fitness model physique while taking all these bumps and while performing at a high level. You can't go out there for 5 minutes and
doing all that travel.
Doing all that travel. And, yeah. You know, I'm in my 40s. I know that my body has changed over the years since I was a teenager and I could eat anything. You know, just literally that slog of being on the road and trying to find clean food to eat and find a gym. And just, yeah, you've used the word pressure a lot, and it's difficult to imagine. And it's difficult to imagine the things now are significantly better than they used to be. It would be a good place to see a lot of changes, including in fan expectations. You know, everybody's seen fighting. You've seen what a professional fighter looks like, what their body looks like when they're in peak performance, you know, peak shape to perform. I think, you know, there are many things that everybody can do here. And one thing that lots of people can do is to just think about their own expectations for what an athlete is supposed to look like, and you know what the difference between cosmetic and real is, even in a fantasy business.
Yeah,
you know, Dave, we had both Medusa and Missy Hyatt on this show at different times, and back when we were doing those shows, I remember some of the feedback being a little bit like, you know, why are they so tough about wanting to be one of the boys or whatever? And it seems like in such a short time, like that mentality, rightfully so, has adjusted. And I almost feel like, you know, the that idea of being accepted and accepting a lot of those things, like that is another, that is another positive that we could come out of this, is just what the expectation is for, you know, the equality or the inclusiveness or whatever of pro wrestling. I think that's another important one.
Yeah. I mean, we've definitely seen changes. I mean, there's women on the roster now and plenty of them that would not have been able to get a job. And they know it too. You know, I've talked to some of them about it, you know, that wouldn't be able to get a job in wrestling 15 years ago because they were looking for a completely different look, no matter their skill level or talking level. Cause you know, the ones that are there, they do have a certain skill level and they do have a certain talking level, or they wouldn't be there, you know? And the look can work against them, but it's not a killer on them. But at the same time, they absolutely still have to stay in, you know, with one or two exceptions because of the gimmick, they still have to stay in exceptionally good shape. You know, because that's just the expectation. Yeah.
Tim, I want to thank you for being on with us for so long. I mean, we did almost 75 minutes. Much appreciative. And I know that people can find you at Tim Marchman on Twitter. And I think what I'm going to do, I might have to turn on the Twitter notifications for your Twitter account so that whenever your next piece comes out or whatever your next reporting is, I will immediately be alerted because it's been pretty much read while this whole situation has been on.
Yeah,
that is really... Oh, no. If you do that, I'm going to post about the White Sox or something for you.
Hey, no, but you've done a really good job with these recent stories. And you know, we want to thank you for being a guest, of course, but... I've been really fascinated because, again, like the stories, the Ashley Massaro story, like hits me because it's again, when I look back, it was like, and covered it. It was like, you know, man, was I, you know, and again, I'm not shocked I was lied to, but it was like, yeah, I was lied to at a higher level than usual, you know, usual twisting of words. This was a bigger level of lie than most things, so to speak.
Yeah, thanks for the kind words about the reporting. I'm continuing it. I can't promise I'll ever do another story about this. I mean, if I don't get anything new worth writing about, then I won't. But I'm certainly talking to people and continuing to look around. I know lots of other reporters are as well. And like, really, my hope is just that things come to light that need to come to light. Because yeah, when you look at the level of just straight up lying that happened there about something so
heinous,
so horrifying.
Yeah.
That's one where I think you can really directly point at that. There are other issues here where it's like, if people were aware that Vince was a lech or he had people in fake jobs or whatever, that can become a complicated question because of the level of total control over the company. But this specific incident, like people who were involved of or aware of that, like I don't, you know, it's not my place to make judgments. I'm just trying to gather the facts, but like, you'd have a real hard time convincing me those people should be in the company. I mean, that's just because that's just, it's just,
yeah,
it's so right terrible. And she was exploited so badly. And in the days after she died, they lied about it. It's awful stuff.
And they played mind games with her too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, over the whole thing. I mean, they wanted to keep it quiet. So they played, you know, they played mind games with her, you know, and that's a big part of it too. You know, and it wasn't like she's coming off of this horribly traumatic thing that no doubt she had probably had nightmares about until, you know, her self-inflicted death, you know. And again, I mean, her friend did say that she was 99% sure it had played into it. And there's no way of knowing, but she's going to know more than we're going to know, you know, mm-hmm. as far as like, you know, the mindset of it. But I could see, you know, you going through the rest of your life with that nightmare. And these, you know, these guys are, they're only concerned about themselves, you know, at the end of the day, which of course we know that. But still, you know, at a certain point, the only concern about yourself has to take a second place, and it didn't here. You know, like there's
yeah. You know what? You know what? If you read that affidavit, you don't see. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't believe there was any mention of like any therapy being offered.
No, there's no mention of it.
Right. That no, hey, you know, we want to keep this. You don't want to talk about this. It's in our interest not to talk about this. But like, how can we help you heal? And you know what else? The previously unpublished part of the statement where she talks about Vince McMahon coming on to her, making these advances. This is after she kind of attributes it to Playboy. She said before she did Playboy, she didn't think she was his type. But that after she did that, he started, you know, trying to get her to come to his hotel room and all that stuff. But this is also fairly after she's had this.
Yeah, this was
incredibly traumatic incident. Like his main dealing with her would actually probably have been telling her they're going to hush all this up. And then so you got this intensely traumatized person and then you're trying to get them to come to your home. It's just, you know, it's just. Like that and the Grant stuff, it's just you can't really imagine anything lower that doesn't involve like a kid or murder. It's just as the allegations are just as bad as you get. And, you know, I don't know. I you can't really say much more than that. I, you know, it's not like to be all self-congratulatory about thinking the stuff is bad. But it's really, like every bit of new information that comes out about this in particular somehow makes it just seem worse. And you're like, how could it be worse? And it gets a little bit worse. So
yeah, and it's weird because like with me, it's a lot of the people involved here are people who I know in a certain way, and not that I even would say I had high thoughts of their moral character, because that would be untrue. But there's a certain level that's like, okay, I know it's the weird wrestling business, and it's kind of how it is, and you kind of when as years go by, you kind of accept it and become almost callous to it. But it's like how uncaring can it get? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can set the bar as low as you want, and
this was low.
People here were below it.
Yeah, that's I think that's the perfect way to say it, actually. Yeah.
So I'll let you guys go. Thanks a lot for having me. Really appreciate it. And, you know, take care and have a good time to everyone out there listening.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Dave, we have a couple of minutes. Now, I think what I'm going to do is we'll push a lot of the stuff that I was going to ask you about, especially around.
We can do this tomorrow.
We'll push it to tomorrow. The Rock, Roman, all that, the story that you wrote, we'll know even more about it because Rock and Roman are going to be on SmackDown, and then they're going to do another taping. So we may know even more if they tape anything with those two guys. But I do want to ask you before we get out of here. UFC 298, which we are going to cover tomorrow. What's your feeling on the show? It doesn't seem like a giant one, so much so that my gym, which part of the reason I have a membership is because they were showing UFC shows, they said they're not doing it this time because there hasn't been much interest, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It's interesting because I think it's a very good show. I think it's a very deep show. But, you know, more and more as time goes on, I mean, when it comes to UFC, I think that, like, there are so few of those what I would call crossovers, very few, really. So, I mean, Alexander Volkanovsky's, you know, great, great fighter, although, you know, he did lose to Makhachev pretty significantly. But that was with very little lead time to train and going against a bigger guy and everything.
And also, did you read about the things that he was saying? He was doing a lot of drinking and he wasn't really, like... So that was interesting. I didn't know about that before.
I didn't either. And one thing I by the way, this is a separate subject, but it doesn't do with UFC. Did you see the Howie Mandel and Dana thing?
I just asked Ryan Frederick, who's going to join us tomorrow. I asked him if he knew anything about that. That's the weirdest thing.
I mean, I don't know, and I haven't asked him, and maybe I should, but I saw it, and it was like, that is just so weird and out of character. You know what I mean? It's like it's like I you know, and the guy was just effusively praising him to a point that it was almost, I was like, dude, have some shame. You know, it's like he was basically saying that Dana, you know,
a role model. He called him a role model.
A role model and an inspiration to us all and all this. And it's just like, look, he's a great fight promoter. I mean, he's not, you know, I mean, he's a great fight promoter, and I can say good things and bad things about him, you know, both, obviously. But the thing is it's like, you know, he says all this, and then Dana just like walks out on his show 30 seconds in.
Yeah, he says he's tired of doing podcasts, and thank you for the compliments, but I'm not going to do anymore. And then he left. I wonder if he was...
Which is funny, because just the last time he was on with Pat McAfee, which was not that long ago, he talked about how much he loved doing shows like this. So I don't know, you know.
Is it possible he may have found out that Howie was going to ask him something that he didn't want to answer?
How was he going to find that out in the first 30 seconds?
I don't know.
If that was the case, he would have no-showed it.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I don't know why he didn't cancel. You know what I mean? If you're in the mood where you don't want to do it and you're Dana White, you can just say, I got a cold. I want to cancel. Let's do it in 3 months and then never do it. Yeah. So, yeah, no, it was like, again, that's one of those things where when I saw it, it's like, there is something here and I do not understand it. Usually, like when it comes to, I used to always say when it comes to Vince, whether I agree or disagree, I could see where he's coming from. That's always had to do with business. And with Dana is the same way. I can get where his business mind is going. And I know when he gets mad at people and all that, you know, whether you agree or disagree with it, I can see when you're in that world where everyone compliments you, how, you know, when, you know, someone's critical of you, you just, whatever, you react and you don't see their side of the story. That's cool. But the, but what he did was just, you know, it's not bad. It's going, you know, trying to compare it to what the Vince stories, you know, it's obviously not even an issue, but I just, when I saw it, I was just like, this is just, I don't know what's going on here.
So a couple of other things. Next Friday is the Observer Awards. We'll be in the next issue.
That will make for a rational weekend next weekend.
And then what's the TNA creative story?
I mean, as far as, you know, Dee Moore's out and Ed Norholm's out and they're, you know, redoing everything. I mean, Scott had been in charge and that's the basic situation. So on the thing I wrote about Dreamer, it was actually somebody who does business with them and just said that, like, the person that they were told is the head of creative and the person to continue the businesses is Tommy. And he will I guess he's going to end up being overseen, but that's by a business person. So, I mean, he may not be the, you know, top guy, but he's the top guy on the wrestling side. You know, it's Tommy Dreamer, Gail Kim, and there's others involved as well. But, you know, he's the guy who's going to be doing, I guess, the creative work, so to speak.
Got it. And No Collision tomorrow. Collision.
And Rampage is on at an earlier time, like actually in a half hour.
Are they showing it multiple times?
Yeah, twice. Once before the game, or not the game, but before the All-Star activities, and then right after, which actually could give them a pretty decent lead-in. You know, certainly a much better lead-in than they usually get. I'll say that. If using some of the lead-ins that, and granted, they get a very good lead-in on Wednesday, but the lead-ins that they get over the weekend, my God, that one show where that averaged like 11,000 in 18-49, that was, you know, lead in to their one of the shows. I think it was lead into a Collision one last week or something, or Rampage. But man, oh man, you know. But yeah, it's yeah, they're going to get a good one. I wish that they had, you know, knowing that they were going to be on right after this NBA stuff. I would have just, like, man, first thing on Rampage. I think whenever they get a chance to get a good sports lead in, and you know, that's never going to happen on a Wednesday, or rarely going to happen on a Wednesday, but it can happen on a Saturday. Or Friday, that I would just load that thing up with a hot angle. So non-fans, you know, in your first
Tony
5 minutes.
Tony would have known too, right? He would have known what.
I guess. I mean, yeah, I would think so. I mean, he would have known before Wednesday when he was putting the TV together. I don't know that, you know, again, with all the things and the way that they do things, you know, and plan out in advance and stuff like that, even though I know that there's a lot of stuff that changes the day of the show and everything, but you know, his, you know, big picture stuff is laid out well in advance. So maybe this is just how he's laid it out and he's not going to change it, but yeah, I don't know what the angle would have been. I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, it's just like, I would just shoot a big, I would have opened the show with a big angle, on the Rampage with the top guys, because you're going to be seen by a different audience and you just want to hook them with the idea you got something big is coming on your pay-per-view. That's my mentality of this.
I was trying to think. They've had Jericho on with the Inside the NBA guys before, but is he still maybe the person that you would put on for that audience who may know some of the wrestlers? Like, who else could you put on? I guess Sting would be another one who basketball fans would probably know just by what he looks like and from back in the day.
I mean, as far as putting someone on one of their broadcasts, that's a different
thing. No, I'm just saying, like, if you expected some NBA audience.
To
the beginning of the show.
Moxley, you know, it's to me, it's more you want to do something big right away with people who are your headliners. You know, it could be Joe. It could be Strickland. I mean, Strickland's the guy they're really, really going to push. He may not be as well known, and he's not, but he's a guy that you're building around. So that would be the guy I would want to throw out. Those would be the guys I'd want to throw out there in the first 15 minutes.
All right. So I guess we'll save just about everything for tomorrow, but we did have a super chat question that Robbie sent in, and he was basically talking about Stephanie being used strategically to talk to Ashley as a woman to be sympathetic, which would just mean that she knew everything.
She knew. Yeah. she's in that story, and it was very well, it was described. And yes, that means that she, that means Stephanie knew. Yes. Which is, you know, I mean, it's something to think about. Yeah. Yeah. But that was, I think that's a very important, thing, you know, and they, you know, Vince wanted a woman to talk to her, and that's the one he chose, which, you know, shows how much Vince thought of her, you know. And but of course, obviously, when it comes to loyalty to the company, you're always going to, you know, you're going to think Stephanie's going to be loyal to the company. But yes, as far as the idea that, that somehow she didn't know on this one, it's there. She knew. Yeah.
And then one other question that we got in that's kind of related to something I asked you and Tim, but from Brian, we are approaching 3 weeks since Vince has been gone. Has there been any internal dialogue from leadership to the talent about why Vince left and what improvements WWE is making to improve safety within the workplace?
Oh God, I asked about that, and it was, I mean, they've been told, and the only thing that they, like when it comes to the grant thing, because that's what I specifically asked about, it was like, nobody's brought up anything in the lawsuit. Nobody's talked about it. Nobody's talked about how we're going to have to make changes to, for anything like that. The only thing they were told is Vince is gone and he's not coming back. That's what they were told. Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll do it from here. I want to thank Tim for joining us for the long conversation. He was here for much longer than we'd even asked him to be. So thanks to Tim. And then tomorrow night after UFC, Dave and I will be back, and I'll get to a lot of the stuff that we usually cover, which are the stories, the main stories from the Observer, and kind of digging into those a little bit more. And then we'll also talk UFC 298, and we'll have some, we'll have an idea about what's going on for SmackDown, which as of this recording is like literally like 90 minutes away. So,
yeah. And, I think the 2 weeks of SmackDown, which is, you know, everything leading to the Chamber show, you know, we're going to have a lot more, but with Rock on, Dwayne on tonight, you know, they're going to probably advance that storyline. I mean, again, I know that the plan was for the tag match on night one as of, you know, a few days ago. Obviously these things change a lot, and, you know, Dwayne's going to do what Dwayne wants to do on the day Dwayne decides. And, you know, I mean, that's just how it is. And you know, it can be challenging, you know, if you want to do something else, because he's, you know, that big of a star. And, you know, I mean, it's been, you know, it's been part of this whole thing. I mean, this story, the, you know, and again, I only touched on the major part of it, but behind the scenes of this story, is, you know, I mean, it's an interesting story. This WrestleMania build has been because of him, has been different than most years, although many years it changes for a bunch of different reasons, whether it's Vince's whims or the fans. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of the most historic things, you know, when it comes to Kofi Kingston's win and Bryan Danielson's win, I mean, the reality is neither of those were planned ahead. I mean, yeah. Kofi Kingston was going to lose on a pay-per-view before WrestleMania. And I think Owens was going to be the guy in WrestleMania that year, but whatever it was, it changed because they just sensed that, you know, we're going to change it. And they kind of did the same blueprint with both of them, in the sense that in both cases, they gave the fans what they want, but they had already decided that it's not really the right thing for business.
Right.
And they were going to, and in both cases with Brock, as a matter of fact, that Brock is going to come in and destroy those guys. And that's going to be it. Then they're back to the mid card, so to speak.
Right. All right. So we'll be back tomorrow night after UFC 298 with Ryan Frederick covering that show. So thanks to Tim, for Dave, I am Garrett. To everybody, thanks for watching and listening.